plenty of action to be discussed from around the sporting world. And once again, the 20-minute hit is going to try and cover all of it in a short space of time. I'm Ollie Wilson, your host and broadcaster for TalkSport, BT Sport and various outlets around the globe. Joining me, as always, is esteemed journalist, Mr. Paul McDonald. And on the show today, I'm delighted to say as well from Goal.com, we have Mr. Chris Vokes. Plenty of action to get into from the start of 2016. Paul, how are you first and foremost? Good to speak to you again, mate.
Yeah, good year so far, apart from if you're a legendary singer or legendary actor, because they're dropping like flies at the moment.
Yeah, the sad news of Alan Rickman passing away today, most recently, of course. Chris, can you put a bit of a positive spin on the start of 2016 for us here, mate?
A little bit of flu knocking around. Not going well at the minute.
Ever the bright and optimistic start from everybody here on the 20-minute hit, that's for sure. Let's dive straight into some of the sporting news from the last 7 days. And let's kick things off with the Ballon d'Or, or perhaps as some people are calling it, the Ballon d'Or at the moment, because once again, Lionel Messi picking up the World Player of the Year award, the World 11 from FIFA as well, looking very familiar, dominated as always by Real Madrid and Barcelona players. Gentlemen, are we tired of the Ballon d'Or in some way, shape or form? Is there really any point in any of the names apart from Messi and Ronaldo being included in this in this trophy?
To me, the purpose of this award has lost its impetus by giving the votes to coaches and players in the game, particularly players, I think, because there's an actual assumption out there, I think, from some people that players know a lot about football simply because they play it. And that, in a lot of cases, just isn't true. There are guys that are picking that list of their top three based on reputation rather than actually ability to watch players. For example, I picked out one that was interesting. The Togo coach, I believe, or Togo captain, one of the two, his top three was De Bruyne, Hazard and Yaya Toure, which is three good players, don't get me wrong, but kind of missing the point of what we're trying to do here. So I think by stretching this award out and giving votes to coaches and players who might not be able to see as much of these players as other places do, I just think you're devaluing the entire award by assuming that they know better. And I think a return to a kind of more journalism-based vote would be optimal to reinvigorate the Ballon d'Or and get us a more accurate representation of who the best players in the world are.
I can hear the bitterness, mainly because Neymar didn't win it as you so surely wanted, Paul. But it's become kind of tactical voting and political voting between teams and managers and players, isn't it? It's everybody choosing their best mates. For instance, you look at Chris Coleman, ended up, of course, picked Gareth Bale to be number one on his list. And there's no real hidden secret why exactly that is as well, Chris. I mean, Would you prefer it if it was purely journalist based, and if so, how do you choose which journalists get the opportunity to make that vote?
I can see the argument for that, and certainly I've heard of players who, you know, if you stop them in the street on a Thursday morning and started talking to them about football, they'd say, "Sorry, mate, don't know much about it," because, as Paul said, you know, there's this assumption that they know what they're talking about just because they're good at it. But I think it almost kind of points out. I agree that for the most part, Ronaldo and Messi are the two best players by far and away, so there's going to be some inevitability about it most years. But this is where they missed a trick in 2010. This is where Wesley Snyder should have got it to break it up, and not just to break it up, because he deserved it. He was the best player that year, and because it's now basically being shared out between Ronaldo and Messi every year, that is more and more looking like a glaring error as an opportunity to show that this really is about picking the best player of the year and not about some political game.
Anybody from the World 11 or perhaps from the Ballon d'Or itself who should feel a little bit hard done by? I know Luis Suarez, a lot of people said, should have been at least in the top three or perhaps in that World 11. What do you guys think?
There's still this thing with Suarez in there that it's about baggage, I think, a little bit. People are not always quick to kind of jump to his defence or to vote for him and stuff. So I think there's a little bit of that with it still. And I think if he continues in his current form, then the same thing next year, I think he'll be in.
Well, it will be interesting to see if Suarez can make it into that top three and into that World 11. And I don't think there's anybody that would say that he doesn't deserve at least a chance and a place to be in that top three. Let's move away from the Ballon d'Or, if you will. And, of course, Sepp Blatter wasn't there. We'll be talking a little bit about FIFA later on. Let's talk about deals in the January transfer window, because it's that time upon us now. Everything's a little bit hectic. Teams trying to salvage their seasons, perhaps move away from the relegation battle, perhaps launch themselves into European spots and into title races. but are there actually deals to be had in January, or is it just a way of agents to make more money off overinflated player sale prices? Gentlemen, do we enjoy anything about the January transfer window? Is there a possibility to pick up big deals at this time of the year?
It was interesting to see the quotes from Jurgen Klopp recently regarding what he thinks of the transfer window. He treats it with a bit of disdain because he feels that, particularly in England, there are so many matches played in January, it doesn't allow players and teams to come together and actually train and recover and actually formulate new tactics. And to ask a player who's been training under different circumstances to be dropped immediately into that in January, he thinks it's not fair on the player and it's not fair on the club to ask him to do that. So his take on it is that the transfer window is kind of, in January, is kind of obsolete because managers like Klopp, and he's not the only one, they like to gather their business at the start of June and have a full summer to teach that team how they're going to lay out their formation tactically for the season ahead and how they're going to play and what their approach is going to be. And if you throw a guy in January, he's not going to be able to really pick that up mid-season. So I think a lot of clubs are taking that approach now and look at it. They only really want to go into the transfer window in January if they really, really have to. Because not only that, not only in terms of training and integrating players into the squad, they know they're going to have to pay over the odds to get a really talented player anyway.
But we've seen in the past, and even before January transfer window was introduced, these windows, that players coming in can have an impact and can make the difference perhaps in the latter part of a season. But I think the difference with the January transfer window is that the prices seem to suddenly skyrocket because it's seen as panic buying, if you will, at this point. Is that a fair assessment, do you think, Chris?
I think now clubs are seemingly more and more self-regulating the system almost because they've decided that we're not going to get the biggest names, the biggest moves that we really want in January. So we'll kind of keep our powder dry until the summer. And it seems to be that clubs have decided all the big moves are going to be in the summer and then it's just going to be a little bit of window dressing here and there when it comes to January. It's almost as though clubs don't really want it. You know, Klopp is not the only one to come out. Louis van Gaal has said in recent days that no big players move in January. I can see why players would want it because I remember when it first came in as a uniform system in, 2002, players saying, well, the thing is, if I'm suddenly out of the team in September, I can't do anything about it. I can't move clubs. If I'm not getting on with the manager, I've got to wait around for 4 months. And you can't really extend that to the rest of the season. So I can see that there's a need for it, certainly lower down in the system, away from the top leagues. But yeah, I think for the most part, big clubs just don't want to use it.
Does anybody need to use it, though, this January? I mean, who in particular around Europe do you think is going to be investing in the in this window?
It's not, to me, it's not a matter of who needs to use it. It's a matter of who they would get anyway. I mean, there's just no value out there to be had. I take your point, Ollie, that it has worked for some clubs in the past, but quite equally, it's worked badly for other teams. You only need to look at Fernando Torres and Andy Carroll and expensive signings like that happened in January that proved to be an absolute disaster. So even though, like you would say, probably Man United would be looking for a striker at the moment, are they going to go out there and get a Lewandowski in January? Absolutely not. So they said they may as well keep their money for the summer.
Save up then until a bit of summer spending for the big sides around Europe. Let's move away from all things European football. Let's talk about a little bit of American football because, of course, we had the playoffs on the weekend. Some very chippy games, some incredible moments taking place over the of Saturday and Sunday, and plenty more coming in the divisional round. But the World Cup weekend threw up some thrills and spills, and in particular, it all started to boil over between the Cincinnati Bengals and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Paul, you were very upset by some of the incidents that we saw on that weekend, but isn't that one of the things that we like about the divisional rivalries, especially when you get into playoff crunch time, is that you get that real chippy, edgy sort of game, you know, with people throwing a few fists after plays, a few brawls on the pitch and on the sidelines as well. Isn't that something that we like to see?
It's not that I'm not interested in kind of passion and aggressiveness when it comes to the playoffs, because we know how much is at stake, Ollie. It's more to do with the incident involving Brown and Pac-Man Jones at the end of the game. Now, that could have been an absolute tragedy. He ran headfirst into Brown almost 2 seconds after the play had been called finished, after the ball had hit the ground and the pass was incomplete. And he just ran headfirst into him. And if Brown hadn't shaped his head at a certain angle, he could easily have broken his neck. Now, there's a fundamental difference between passion and aggression and stupidity. And this, unfortunately, fell into the latter. And a lot of the match, to me, was involved in petty incidents and just stupidity overall rather than actual aggression and will to win. And I think there's a real difference between the two.
But we saw, for instance, early on in the latter part of the season, when the Panthers met the New York Giants, things Odell Beckham Jr., you know, flinging cheap shots in on Newman in the corner that was covering him for the Panthers throughout a game, throwing fists, and of course had that horrible blindside hit where he just tried to literally knock Newman out as hard as he could. This is something that we see with great players doing it over kind of in big games, in big moments, when they need to be on that edge, if you will, to get the best out of their performance. Do you not see that in any... I'm not condoning what Pac-Man Jones did, and he's got prior history, as we saw with Amari Cooper earlier this season. But do you not think that that's one of these cases of just a player that needs to play on that edge and just letting it all boil over slightly in a game that was so intense and so full of chippiness anyway? It almost seemed inevitable, like when we get in football, a red card's guaranteed to happen sometimes.
No,
sometimes you can try too hard to explain away just acts of foul play, and I think this... there's a clear line, and I think we all know that this one clearly stepped over the line, and if you give long bans to players who are guilty of these, then you start to use it as a deterrent. But I think there's a clear line, and this was definitely over it.
It won't matter for the Bengals. They're, of course, out of the playoffs, beaten by the Steelers, who are worried about Ben Roethlisberger and his fitness coming into this weekend. Who'd want to be an NFL kicker, though? Blair Walsh puts up 9 points, the only 9 points that the Minnesota Vikings get, but misses the big one to pick up 12 in the dying seconds of their game against the Seattle Seahawks. Gentlemen, is it the toughest position in world sport, being a kicker? You're expected to make every single kick 90% of the time, unless it's a 54-yarder plus. Even in those conditions, Blair Walsh was expected to find 3 points and put the Vikings through.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also the psychological element of being a kicker as well. You're on the sidelines for much of the match and only called upon when your team needs you to score those points. So to having to sit there and not be involved in the match at all and then come in fresh in order to just make that important kick, you really need to be psychologically strong and confident in your own ability to be able to do that on a regular basis. And let's face it, there isn't many other sports where 100% strike rate is demanded by the discipline of the sport. I can't think of too many others. So yeah, it's very unique in that regard. And I feel sorry for the guys that they don't actually get it, because as you say, it damages their reputation and puts them down the list and brings in somebody else who can try and keep that 100% record.
It's interesting. I think everybody who watched Ace Ventura will have been saying, yeah, but guys, we all know lace is out on every single kick, and Blair Walsh didn't get that. We will move away from the NFL playoffs. Let's talk a little bit about David Haye coming up this weekend. His return to professional boxing after his retirement. Hasn't fought in something like 3-4 years now, I think it is. Haye back in the ring at the O2. Is it a credible comeback, or is this just a publicity stunt for David Haye, who perhaps just needs a little bit of extra cash in the pocket? Is he a genuine heavyweight title contender, gentlemen, Chris?
I think after 4 years out, you've got to question the motives. You know, David Haye has been a great boxer in his time, but, you know, after so long out, and also there's this thing with Haye, he's one of these kind of growing band of boxers, and I suppose it's always been the case a little bit with boxing, that the reputation and the kind of the TV side of the persona is almost bigger than the boxing side of it. And he seems to be a guy who likes to stay in the media and stuff, and maybe he's just missing out on the spotlight a little bit and feels the need to come back. But I think, you know, if he's really going to go for a proper tilt at the world title, then he's got a long road ahead of him still, I think.
Paul, are you going to be checking in on his fight against Mark DeMori this weekend? I mean, DeMori's not exactly one of the big boys in the heavyweight rankings, round about in the top 100 or so when it comes to heavyweight boxers. Is this something that's grabbing any attention at all for you, or is it just, all right, well, David Haye's back in the ring and then we'll see what he does after this?
No, no interest in this whatsoever. I knew when Haye said a few years ago that he was retiring that he'd end up coming back. He strikes me as that kind of character that likes to be controversial and make statements like, oh, I'm retiring, I'm done, and then reverse that decision. Boxers, as a discipline, tend to do that a lot at the top end, say they're not fighting anymore, and then they always get lured back for one last paycheck. So you just need to look at the amount of times that Mayweather has said he's retired and then he's fought again. So, yeah, it's hardly a stellar comeback, is it? And again, to hark back to what I've said previously, if he ends up in a world title fight again, it shows the depth of talent at the top end of boxing, that a guy like him, who wasn't even particularly good to begin with, in my view, can take three years away from the sport or 2 years away, and then come back and immediately enter the title picture again. Yeah, it's pretty depressing.
What if he comes back though? Because before he finished, he was fighting one fight a year. Of course, he had Chisora in 2012, Klitschko in 2011, Audley Harrison in 2010. It wasn't exactly stacking up his schedule in terms of big fights. However, if he comes back and starts putting in maybe, you know, five or six fights a year, starts really working hard at it, is that a way for him to perhaps garner back a bit of the reputation that he had as being one of the great British boxers?
First of all, I think that kind of schedule for Hay is highly unlikely. He's not the kind of guy that does that type of schedule. Whether it's to do with arrogance on his part to think that he can only build up a pay-per-view audience based on one fight a year, or whether it's just something to do with his training schedule, which will take even longer now that he's a few years old and he needs to get back to top fitness again. I can't see that happening. And even if it did, it would need to be a spectacular comeback to make me notice him again, because frankly, even when he was at his best and fighting Valuev, etc., and fighting Klitschko and stuff, he wasn't my identikit boxer anyway, and not somebody I enjoyed watching.
I think he's one of those guys that is just what boxing is at the moment. A lot of talk without really any substance going along with it, particularly in that heavyweight division. All right, gentlemen, we'll finish off the first podcast of 2016 on an upbeat note, as we started in such an enthusiastic, upbeat way. And let's talk about transfer bans. Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid have also been handed bans for registering players in the next two transfer windows. Chris, you're the man to really talk to about this sort of thing, being the European football aficionado that you are. This isn't good news for Spanish football in general, let alone for Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid at the moment, having this transfer ban laid down on them.
No, it's quite stark, isn't it, that now that all three of the top clubs in Spain, the three clubs that have been challenging for pretty much everything in recent years, have been banned for a year, basically, from signing players because of their practices with underage players. And it's a real kind of stark subject, really, the fact that it's been going on and clubs have found it so easy to kind of pass through transfers. We're not talking one or two transfers. Barcelona was a good handful of transfers. Real Madrid, there was a list of 51 players, I think it was, last year going around that Real Madrid could be banned for. And, you know, that's led to this now and the actual ban. So it really is a crazy kind of practice that's been going on, and it's only right that they've been banned. And yeah, it doesn't sit Spanish sport, Spanish football in a good light that this has happened at all. And you know, even now for Barcelona, for instance, they're going to want to kind of cash in on the fact that they can make transfers and the other two can't, but there's only so many players they could take on. The Spanish transfer market is going to be a bit of a shambles, I think, over the next year.
Well, there was a discussion about when Barca were handed their transfer ban back in April 2014, that perhaps Real Madrid and to a lesser extent Atletico Madrid would be able to capitalise on that. Do you genuinely think, though, that Barca will be able to make a big enough splash that allows them to pull significantly away from these two in terms of being able to bring in and attract those sorts of high-quality players? Because, let's face it, in terms of world football and being able to bring in players, Real Madrid and Barcelona are the two sides that nobody seems to say no to. Now it's just Barca are they going to be the side that nobody says no to right now. Is this going to make a big impact in where we see La Liga titles going for the next, say, 12 to 18 months?
I think the big problem here is one that involves Manchester United. I think United would have been preparing to court Bale and Ronaldo this summer. And now Real Madrid, they can't afford to let either of those two players go because they can't bring anyone else in to replace them. So you're left with a Cristiano Ronaldo who might potentially have been looking to wind up his Real Madrid career this summer. It might have changed. Certainly if Benitez had stayed to the summer, Ronaldo would have been looking elsewhere. Maybe it might have changed for him because Zidane's there, but Ronaldo's also going to be heading into his 32nd year soon, and they need to find a replacement for him sooner rather than later. So I think the problem lies as much in the fact that Madrid can't move players out that potentially want to go back to England or move somewhere else, and they can't suitably replace them, as much as it involves in competing with Barcelona in the market.
Just finally, gentlemen, on this then, the obviously moving around these under 18 players, is this something that we're happy we're seeing that teams are getting punished for now? We've spoken about financial fair play before and how that doesn't seem to make too much of an impact at the moment. But these bans for the movement of under 18 players, is this a positive thing because it stops these players from basically have being carted around the world at such a very young age and potentially having their footballing prospects damaged by this sort of thing?
Yeah, we can't see 16, 17, 15, 14-year-old kids being, as you say, carted around the world and then just dumped, because that's the reality of the large majority of them. You know, yes, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Atletico are going to be looking at the very best players, and so most of them you would expect would end somewhere. But the actual practice of it, the fact that it's such a cutthroat business to be carting teenage kids through, yeah, you don't want that at all. And yeah, I think it's, as I say, it's only right that FIFA and UEFA really step on this practice while it's so ripe.
Always a happy note to finish on, gentlemen here on the 20-minute hit. Chris, a massive thanks for you for joining us here on the show today. Paul, I'm sure we'll be catching up next week to discuss another 7 days of sporting action. Cheers, gentlemen. Really appreciate your time as always.
Cheers, Ollie.
Cheers, mate.
And thank you very much for catching up with us. Remember to catch us on Twitter at 20minutehit. We'll be back in 7 days' time. Have a very good week and enjoy all the sport coming your way. Have a good one.